Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 2nd of August, 1995. In the Creekside Room this evening, our speaker is Ann Palmerton, and she will be speaking on Reimagining God, Church, and Community. So let's listen in on Ann.
I serve as an associate pastor at a Presbyterian church in Columbus, Ohio, Broad Street Presbyterian Church. And I attended the Reimagining Conference, and more to follow.
And I'm Robin Henry, and I'm the Director of Music and Liturgy at a Roman Catholic Church in Minneapolis, St. Albert the Great, Dominican Parish. And I attended the Reimagining Conference, and I am a part of the Reimagining community that still exists, at least in Minnesota. I know that much, though.
My name is Kathleen Olson, and I'm Robin's partner, and we led a session at Reimagining.
And where do you work?
And I work at St. Martin's Table in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is a restaurant and bookstore, Peace Education Center.
We'd like to begin, as we are able, to sing together, Come, O Holy Spirit, Come, number 681 in, what's it called?
With one voice.
681. As we focus,
we'll start off with a wah-wah, okay? And then we will sing that twice and then sing the English twice.
Could you sing it too?
Sure. Have a listen.
I was finding my eyes filling hearing that, because I was saying to a few people, I've been in gatherings of many people to talk about the Reimagining Conference, but never have we started with a song, and never has it been a climate with much demeanor to it. The Presbyterian denomination, as you may or may not know, erupted after the Reimagining Conference in ways that maybe surprised us all in terms of small-mindedness and cruelty and personal attack. We, as a denomination, we've really been through the ringer this last year. And you might say the Reimagining Conference was the crisis, meaning the danger and the opportunity, that came together to let us face our own issues as a denomination. And so I want to tell you why. And were any of you at the conference? I should ask before. Okay, so there's another voice. If at some point in all of this you'd like to say something, let us know. I'm a woman of faith. I'm a Presbyterian woman of faith. And I'm a clergywoman. And the first and the greatest commandment, Scripture says, is to love God with all of ourselves, with our heart, with our soul, with our mind, with all of our strength. And women, in increasing numbers, are seeking to love God with our whole selves. And we are giving new voice to this ancient calling. And we're not of one voice. There are a whole set of diverse voices. But we are united in our desire to speak and to inform the life of faith and the life of the church. So women have been about this for a long time. This is nothing new. But the Reimagining Conference that occurred in November of 93 was a chance to come together and to be together as women of faith. So I wanted to give you an introduction to the Reimagining Conference. You see this logo on these t-shirts and here, and let you know a little bit about it. The ecumenical decade, Churches in Solidarity with Women, was the name given to a 10-year span of time. 1988 to 1998 was declared the ecumenical decade, Churches in Solidarity with Women, by the World Council of Churches. And one of the Reimagining presenters, Lois Wilson, has an anecdote to share about the creation of that decade. She says she was on the World Council of Churches at that time as a former president of the World Council and as a pastor in Canada. So Lois Wilson said this, when the motion to launch the decade came to the floor of the Central Committee in 1987, it was very interesting. It's really embedded in my heart. A bishop from New Zealand spoke into the microphone and said, "I don't see why we need a decade for churches in solidarity with women. I have no trouble with my wife." Then there was an Anglican canon from Ireland who said, "I don't think we need to give you a whole decade." And so Lois said, I got to the microphone and I said, "Listen, we are not asking you to give us anything. We are announcing a decade. And judging by your response, sir, you're going to need a decade to catch on to what it's all about." When the World Council announced a decade, it sounds so ethereal. 10 years to talk about churches being in solidarity with women. What does that mean? How does it get to the grassroots? How can we talk about economic justice and violence against women and standing in solidarity with the third world? How can you make that real? Well, what happened was some people in Minnesota decided that they wanted to make it real. And grounding that in the goals of the decade, 5 goals, empowering women to challenge oppressive structures in the global community, their country, and the church, affirming women through shared leadership and decision-making, theology, and spirituality, giving visibility to women's perspectives and actions in the work and struggle for justice, peace, and the integrity of creation, enabling churches to free themselves from racism, sexism, and classism, from teachings and practices that discriminate against women, and encouraging the churches to take actions in solidarity with women, are the 5 goals of the decade. And a gathering of people, an ecumenical gathering in Minnesota began this task, which Robin will allude to in a minute, in a 2-year process of pulling together an enormous committee, even enormous by Presbyterian standards, to create this experience. Who came to the Reimagining Conference? 2,200 participants, 2,200 people, with 1,300 turned away. Two-thirds of the people who came were lay people. One-third were clergy. There were 1,743 women and 83 men. Okay. This was a conference planned by women for women and men. There were 34 presenters who were all women. 49 states were represented, not Nevada. I don't know why. 27 other countries. In terms of denominations, just to give you a flavor, 405 Presbyterians, 391 Methodists, 313 Lutherans. 239 Roman Catholics, UCC, United Church of Canada, Episcopal, Baptist, American Baptist, Church of the Brethren, Mennonite, Quaker, Moravian, one Buddhist. Okay? Kind of gives you the flavor for the experience. Do you want to say something about the planning process here?
Right. The way that I got into the planning process is that a woman that I know from Notre Dame when I studied at Notre Dame, who came to Minnesota to work, her name is Sue Side Martin. She was on staff at the School of Divinity, the St. Paul Roman Catholic Seminary. And Sally Hill, who was the Presbyterian clergywoman who was in charge of the event, talked to Sue and said, "We need help with our ritual. We Presbyterians, we Lutherans, we Methodists, we don't know how to do ritual. You Roman Catholics do. Help us." So they called Sue in, and Sue called many of us who are her friends and pupils to be the dancers, the artists, the musicians, the dreamers. And we sat and we met and we talked and talked for at least a year and a half about what the events would be, what the dances would be, what the rituals would be. We really weren't in terms of what the presentations were about at all. We just were about the ritual themselves, about this ritual is the beginning evening liturgy. On Thursday, we had four choirs that were on four different places in the room. So you had an experience of circular sound. Can you imagine in an auditorium having four choirs with choir directors and pianists trying to stay together? Mm-hmm. And so those people were just pulling their hair out trying to do that, but they did it. It was just an incredible endeavor to try to have an experience that was unusual and different and not the traditional stage assembly here and here are the presenters and the performers up here. So that's how I was invited in to help with the music, and then I was privileged to be with the group that did the leading of the music. And there was a center platform that was where the presenters were presenting and where the music came from if it wasn't from the four stages, this center platform. And when things were delivered, when there was a talk, it wasn't given to only one section of the room. They'd give 10 minutes to one section of the room, they'd turn the podium, and they'd deliver 10 minutes to this section of the room. They'd move the podium, 10 minutes to that. So everybody in the room got that person's face and voice right on them. So it was that kind of experience. And then the other part of it in terms of the music is we were called to look for music that was written by women. And it was pretty challenging because there isn't a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And so some women were commissioned to write music for this particular event, and they did. And one of the songs is from St. Clair. A woman named Kathy Tissell Nelson, who is also a friend of mine, and it's a remarkable St. Clair's text, and Kathy wrote this, and they used it for the conference. And Jean Cotter wrote a song that was used. She's also a kind of a nationally known musician. So.
Mm. We wanted to talk about the environment, to continue what
yes.
you've entered. An anecdote, a personal anecdote. I knew a friend who was going to be coming to this conference, and we spoke on the phone and said, "Oh, let's plan to meet up at the, you know, after the first presentation. We'll go up to the podium up in the front, and we'll meet there." And then we said, "Oh, you know, those feminist conference. Who knows where the podium will be?" Well, then we get in and we find this array that Robin has just described. That in the center of the people is where the expression is coming from, and that even that locale is moving on the platform, so how could we meet at the podium? But we wanted all, including Sue Larson, who I haven't yet introduced, but who's from West Lafayette, Indiana, and who was at the conference, to say something about the environment. From my perspective, it was like entering a foreign land, a land that maybe I've known all my life, but I've never really seen. Entering an experience where sitting around tables covered with paper, given permission to doodle and draw as we're listening, also given, as we had conversation around the table, holding a gourd, which we called a talking gourd, so that you really focused on the person who had that gourd. They got to talk, and we had to listen. Hearing the music come from all the different sides of the huge conference room, and I guess that's enough for me. Do you want to add to the environment? Or
They also handed out musical, they're called Eggs, E-G-G-Z, and they're like shakers. And everybody was invited during the musical portions to dance if they wanted to, or shake, or, I mean, it was a completely different kind of conference than I've ever been to. You were invited to use another portion of your brain and draw and color and rip and dance and shake, and you could get out of your chair if you wanted to. You could go over and hug your friend if you wanted to. It wasn't like being, you know, chained in a chair for the whole conference and thinking, oh, how long is this going to be? When do we get out? It wasn't that experience at all. It just was so different. What about anything else?
Word on that or no?
The convention hall itself was decorated with very large banners that had been commissioned primarily for this event. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, I recall almost floor to ceiling, and there were several sets of them around this very large room, which made for a very festive environment. There were also two painters, I believe two, commissioned from that were on the stage off to the side for the entire conference, worked on a mural. And their rendition of the conference grew and evolved during the course of the event itself. I was trying to do the math, 200 round tables, because mm-hmm. there were 10 of us. Mm-hmm. So surrounding the round stage, there were 200 round tables with 10 participants at each table. We stayed with those small communities throughout the entire conference, which meant that we came to know those 10 people very well. Mm-hmm. And they participated with us throughout the conference in not only hearing the presentation, but also reflecting time on those presentations. I think for me, though, I was reflecting this afternoon on this, that, aesthetically, the art and the room had been so well planned. The most beautiful part of the room was the women and the participants, because there were so many varieties of women. There were so many colorful costumes. There were so many lively personalities. And the collection of those participants in one place created a flavor unlike any that I had ever been part of before.
Okay. Maybe to plant one seed at this point, in terms of the Presbyterian denomination, the conference as a whole cost $390,000 when all was said and done. Seed money was required at the beginning, and the Presbyterians kicked in $66,000 in order to be the seed money, the promise to bring these international participants from all around the world. So that's the hook that got us so embroiled later. If any of you were here last week for Tim Weber's presentation about money, his comment to us on a daily basis was, follow the money, and you'll find out where the power really lies. And that's kind of what was happening within our denomination. A lot of money went, and it wasn't understood to what it was going until it all came out later. We wanted to talk a little bit about creating the space to name the hunger. And maybe I got at it a little bit personally when I said, entering into this foreign land, just the experience of the convention center, the way it was set up, and as the liturgy and the ritual unfolded over the few days, I found myself in a space to ask questions and do reflection that I might not have even known was part of me or my questioning until I got to that place. And I don't know if this is making any sense or not, but the space was created, the environment was created to a place of safety, I guess is a word that we shared, to reflect and ask deep questions on all kinds of levels, personal, theological, historical, psychological. Mm-hmm. Do you want to chime in on that point, or would you like to move on? Okay. You want to sing? Bring Many Names.
Yes. Let's okay. do that one first. The three songs that we're doing tonight were all from the. We used them all at Reimagining, and this next one is a poem by Brian Wren, and we used for the conference itself. We used four of his verses of this poem. Bring Many Names. And then a woman named Teresa Cotter wrote three other verses that we aren't going to do those tonight for you. And the woman who wrote the music is a colleague of mine in Minneapolis. Her name is Donna Kasbaum. Mm-hmm. She's a marvelous musician and mother and grandmother. And okay, so.
You want them just to jump in from there?
Yeah, I think so. It's it's pretty simple melody.
Probably, Robin and I can probably sing the first verse, and then once you get it, just join in.
Familiar with Brian Wren, you notice the lush depth of his poetry and images set beside one another that maybe don't seem to go together but work to increase our own sense of things. Joyful darkness, far beyond our seeing, closer yet than breathing. I mean, the transcendence, the immanence, all mixed together. I know how hard it is if you have some friends and they've just been on a long journey and they come back and they want to show you all their slides. You know what that's like, sitting through the monologue? We're aware that we're on the verge of that. We're celebrating and experiencing something that we have felt so deeply. We're trying to communicate that, and I know that that's hard. In order to enter this next section of individual stories in which we'll share out of our experience, I wanted to read a few paragraphs by the woman who set the tone for the conference, meaning that she gave the first plenary presentation on Thursday night. Her name is Mary Farrell Bednarowski, and she's a professor of religious studies at United Theological Seminary in the Twin Cities, and she grew up as a Roman Catholic. She said her first 27 years of, until the age of 27, she hadn't attended a public school. It was all in the Roman Catholic tradition. Here's what she said. We have been waiting for each other for a lifetime, even though we have been planning this conference for just 3 years. We have come together from many parts of the world to reimagine our religious traditions and our places in them. We have come to claim the deepest depths of Christianity. We have come to do it together, to say to each other, this is our work that needs to be done. This is work that we are obligated to do, and no one of us can do it alone. We have come together to do this work out of our experiences as women of faith who share the conviction that our tradition has the resilience, the inexhaustible resources and creativity to sustain a reimagining of its most central symbols. We come together as people of faith who know that a tradition that cannot reimagine itself cannot survive, and who know that a tradition that does not listen to many voices will not be whole. We come together as women and men of faith who claim that being loyal to a tradition means having the confidence that its most profound symbols are indeed inexhaustible. We cannot get to the bottom of them. We claim that our sacred texts have meanings for our times that have not yet been imagined, that our rituals, if they are enacted in love and in justice, will hold us together and give us the courage to go forth into the world. My own story includes two pieces of theology, I guess, that mean so much to me. The first experience of the conference that had tremendous impact on me was the conference designers taking the initiative to focus on God's immanence. We're used to focusing on God's transcendence. And we're used to also having a balance with that, but I'd say primarily we focus on God's otherness, God's majesty and glory. Certainly the Presbyterians do. The sovereign one, the awesomeness of God. And so to have a conference that very intentionally chose to focus on God's immanence was a marvelous experience for me personally. Secondly, attending a conference in which all references were to God, to the Holy One, were done with pronouns of the feminine gender was a completely new experience for me. And I have stumbled over myself more than once trying to communicate what that felt like. And the phrase that I came up with was a sense of oneness with otherness. Okay? I don't know how, cut out of the same cloth, truly made in the image of God. I've always known from here on up that I'm made in the image of God. I mean, the Bible has told me so since my early days. But I guess to experience that in all its fullness was a profound experience of identity for me. And that's something that that will never leave. It was a great gift. Those of you who attended, if you'd also like to share an experience, or
I wanted to ask you when we spoke the other day, you had also another phrase that it was the first place that you went where you felt that you didn't have to reinterpret.
To interpret.
Can you say more about
yeah.
that?
Yeah. To translate.
To translate.
This is the part about the foreign land. This is entering the foreign land when for the first time as a Christian woman, I didn't have to make the interpretive leap in my head in terms of God's gender and my gender. So I didn't have to do that interpretive work. And doing realizing that made me realize that I always am doing that interpretive work.
Yeah. As mentioning, in the tradition that I come from, I work for one church in 234 that uses inclusive language, that Rome doesn't allow, okay? But we use it because there are people in our community, lay people, who say that the image of God is important to us, important to include all people. But right out of the Roman lectionary, it would be my brothers in Christ. And that's the way it would always be in many, many Roman Catholic churches. So for those of us that came to this conference as Roman Catholics, I was accustomed to a lot of inclusivity. But for others, it was like, excuse me? You're referring to me. How about my sisters in Christ or my brothers and sisters in Christ? Maybe for the first time hearing that was just earth-shattering. And I was thinking of that the image as a mother gathers her lost chicks. There was a priest in Minneapolis who was severely reprimanded because he invited women to come to the altar to say that prayer together because they have gathered their lost chicks, as a mother has gathered her lost chicks. But the church said, excuse me, it has to be a man who can only say this prayer. And he felt so empowered he read the prayer and he said, I can't say this by myself. So he invited other people from the community, men and women, but clearly they were not ordained Roman Catholic celibate males, you know, and they said this prayer, and of course Rome came down and, you know, chopped them for that. It's the same thing that you have to be careful about what comes out of your mouth, you know. So that was another thing for me to have that freedom. It was wonderful with music, with the prayers that were spoken. Another thing that happened for me, and this was quite unexpected, in the middle of the conference, anybody who was in solidarity with lesbian women was invited to come forward or stand in solidarity. And when I heard this, I thought, well, that's me, and I'm going to do this. And there were many people there who were Roman Catholics who knew me in whatever role they thought I was, who didn't know that I was a lesbian, and I thought, this is important. This is a part of who I am. It doesn't change anything. For some people, it changes everything. Mm-hmm. But it was very important for me to have the freedom to stand up and to be able to say, this is who I am, and it's okay. I'm Roman Catholic. I'm lesbian, and it's okay. And there are other people who are Roman Catholic and not lesbian who were in solidarity with me, and other people who are lesbian and Presbyterian or straight and Presbyterian who stood up and were just in solidarity with us. People were visibly weeping. It was just unbelievable that there was a safe place to be who you were, not just a church. There's one church, I shouldn't say that, probably three churches in Minneapolis where you could be an out lesbian, okay? Certainly not a Roman Catholic church, I'll say that much.
The panel discussion that Robin and I participated in was it was five women that were lesbian women in different denominations. And we represented, of course, the Roman Catholic tradition. And also we co-parent three children. And we were able to tell our story, our personal story, and how we reconcile it all with our faith life. And it was very supported by people that were there. I mean, of course, it was a supportive audience, but it was a very affirming time for us to speak about our faith in this way, but also to be in an out safe place. And then we shared how it can be schizophrenic to be a part of a church that does not recognize that or recognizes only part of you. So it was quite an affirming experience for both of us.
I would like to defer some to the people here, and would it be appropriate to see if there are questions about, we've tried to say a lot in a short time.
Right, and we still have so much more.
And there's not much time left. Are we communicating anything?
There
are questions.
Unless you want to say something too about her experience.
Would you like to say, we'll ask you if you'd like to say anything, or
about
we can take a question.
Sure, I'll say two short things.
Okay.
And one had to do with the environment. And one thing that impressed me so much about this conference was that each day, your table moved. And so one day, you may have been way at the fringes in the back, and may not have been able to see the speaker as well, but the next day, your table was right next to the podium. And I thought that was just great, that there was sort of this egalitarian feel. Nobody had a better view for the whole conference than anyone else. And then in terms of a personal story, for me, the sort of embodied nature of the conference was so impressive that people dance, and I think so often in your church, everybody just sits quietly, and when we share the piece, we just turn to the people that are kind of just within reaching distance, in a lot of churches, not all. And so it just felt very, like your whole person was involved, and not just your head, or... Mm-hmm. It had a very unchurchy feel to me, and but it was church. It was church, so it was neat.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a question?
I didn't have a question, but I just wanted to thank you for sharing, because you are expressing what sounded like it was very meaningful to you, and I appreciate you sharing.
I have some questions.
Okay.
I might be the only one, but what does it mean by standing in solidarity? And also, what did you mean by the focusing on the imminence of God?
Standing in solidarity is a kind of one of those, what do you call it? Well, jargon words now. We use it so much. At this point, it literally meant that by standing, you were saying to someone, I'm with you, or I don't fully understand your journey, but I'm willing to experience what I can of it right now. And I support you.
I'm with you.
I'm with you, yeah. And imminence, that's another class. often we talk about our experience of the living God in one of two ways. Transcendence, meaning kind of beyond us, outside of the universe, the majestic awesomeness of the living God. Immanence, meaning God's working in my neighbor, through my neighbor. God's working in community, more the sense of the horizontal relationship, I guess you'd say, of God's working out in and among people in history.
It's important to say that the presenters didn't all agree as they planned.
Right.
Every piece of all the information.
Right. There was no one theological understanding of everyone who presented at this conference. Women flew in from all over the world and made their presentations and hadn't really, you know, schmoozed beforehand to get it all evened out, but just kind of presented. So this wasn't an academic theological conference. It wasn't aimed to be that, but a global kind of colloquium of women doing theology from all over the world, desiring to speak out of the place where they were doing that work and that thinking. We know that the staff needs to leave at 7 for a gathering in the fireside room. We're going to continue till 7:15.
And then tomorrow
at the same time to continue the conversation. So if staff would like to leave now,
we have like 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
So
yeah.
can we hit
the controversy? All right. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
What Paul said is important with regard to the controversy, though, because in the controversy, whether it was on the internet or in the publications or in whatever conversation took place, without fail, 2 or 3 very small pieces of the conference were lifted up as the focal point. And in no way, by no stretch of the imagination, were those, any of those, the focal point of the conference. And I would say that without fail, all of the presenters would have had different views of those themes of controversy, and so that the idea that this somehow is a
seamless
conspiracy to whatever is simply not true. It's not there. The creating a space to name the hunger, the hungers were many, the thirsts were many, and to focus on a phrase like thigh nectar was simply inappropriate. And that was certainly the one that came forward, as you all know, the most frequently. And that was a grave misrepresentation of the intent of the conference.
Okay, that's helpful. Thigh nectar. Did you hear it? Thigh nectar. Maybe.
Time for a song?
Thigh, as in thigh. Yeah. I've had numerous experiences talking about this conference. One was to a presbytery, which is a little bit like the Lutheran Synod, which was very frustrated about what they had heard, and they asked me about thigh nectar, so I can get right at it. To me, the unfortunate nature of the controversy that erupted, it began with some reporters from a very conservative publication calling itself Presbyterian, but not funded by Presbyterian money, called the Presbyterian Layman, which it just the name itself gives you evidence that... So the Presbyterian Layman had reporters at the Reimagining Conference, and they... one woman in particular, who I know personally, was taking it all down and later then framed the issues that the church was going to deal with. And that we've talked about this some. This is one of my greatest griefs, that what happened was a reactionary press got to frame the issues rather than participants at the conference. So what was happening was people who hadn't been to this conference were quoting other people who hadn't been to the conference, and then suddenly this thing is alive.
And then two of the articles that came out in the Minneapolis paper were written by people who had not been to the conference. They had no business writing about it. And so they did not write what happened. They write what they wrote what they heard other people say. But it was just wrong.
Okay, so there's
representation.
Should we talk about the controversy? Yeah, do you want to sing the Sophia song?
Sure.
Yeah,
we can do that.
Okay. Are you sure you want to do the connect but by?
We'll do that first. And then we'll
okay. Sue mentioned thigh nectar, and one of the conference had various parts: a gathering, what was called making holy time, the spirit of reimagining that each woman addressed, and one of the pieces was a blessing over milk and honey, clearly not a substitute for communion, which was clear given the communities that were involved couldn't happen. I mean, we don't have table fellowship with Rome.
Right.
So this was not an attempt to have some kind of strange communion service. Milk and honey were shared at the tables among the women sitting at the tables, and a litany was read. And one of the pieces of the litany had to do with this image of God as wisdom, Sophia, and it got very graphic in terms of sexual imagery, erotic imagery, and that's what this thigh nectar that Sue was referring to says. And this is the line that certainly caught my denomination's interest. Our sweet Sophia, we are women in your image. With nectar between our thighs, we invite a lover. We birth a child. With our warm body fluids, we remind the world of its pleasures and sensations. Well, I was shocked to hear this. Personally, I mean, that's a lot of graphic, physical, sexual imagery in the experience of worship and church, and a lot of times references to the body at all aren't made. I mean, it's more to our spiritual nature than our physical. I think theologically, the whole desire to reinforce for everyone that we are made in God's image, and that's not just our spirit alone, but our whole body is in this process of being redeemed and loved and cared for. One of the things that I've done with my congregation was to remind them of the graphic, erotic imagery in the Song of Songs. And one of the ways that this was able to be communicated to my congregation was reading several of those chapters to them, which their mouths were open anyway. We don't preach from that. I don't know if you do, but we don't. And then to hear this language. So the reactive press accused this conference of kind of being
just women's sexuality gone crazy. What's next? And this was really the lesser of the accusations to me. Are you with me on this? Okay. The next issue was framed over the use of the word Sophia. Which, does anyone know what that word means?
Wisdom.
Wisdom. Sophia is a Greek word. The Hebrew word for wisdom is used in Proverbs a lot. It's chokmah, and then there's Sophia. Just like the word Petros means rock, right? Peter means rock. Mm-hmm. Sophia means wisdom. One of the attributes of the Holy God is the attribute of wisdom. And it just so happens that this is a word that has a feminine gender in Greek. I've often speculated if we were celebrating the rockness of God and had done something to Peter, if this would have blown as it did. Do you know what I mean? But this was the image that was opened up. So would you like to share the Sophia blessing?
Make sure we have the text right.
Yeah.
Could you explain how the blessing was used in the conference?
Before each presenter in the plenary session would speak, this Hawaiian chant was chanted led by a Hawaiian woman doing hand motions, but all of us joined in.
It's adapted for the conference from a traditional Hawaiian chant, part of the oral traditions, and it is in the public domain. But this was also an attempt to make it global, so that music was picked from Asia and Hawaii and North America and Africa and South America. That was part of the whole idea, is that we are a globe.
Bless Sophie.
If every preacher that got up to preach on every liturgy was blessed with this blessing before they got up, you know, the vision, the wisdom deep within. It was just amazing. Every presenter was blessed with this blessing.
And that's the immanence piece. You know, dwelling deep within, evoke from within the wisdom given by God. And Sophia became a lightning rod, and I think still is at some level in the conversation. The exact identification of Sophia and the way the focus on Sophia was used. I can speak for the Presbyterians. We like to study things a lot before they move anywhere. And what happened in this conference was Sophia wasn't studied or quantified. She was introduced and she was part of the worship experience. And that's where the real rub in my denomination came down. You do not try on anything theologically in worship. You try things on theologically in a theological analysis in a study fashion, but you don't do it in worship. That's a big, big point of contention with us right now. But the way this conference just invoked and invited, and there, Sophia, this image of God, this image of wisdom, was right there. And then later in the handouts that came to people was the explanation. So as a clergywoman, I knew about Sophia from my studies in seminary. The Roman Catholic tradition, I think, is familiar with Sophia, and the traditions that is most familiar with Sophia is the Eastern Orthodox, which, for whom this is really kind of a non-issue. It's so interesting. And I've brought some handouts in the back table about this Sophia, so you can read about this, pro and con, so you can have an understanding for yourself. Yeah?
Were they using it to name an attribute of God or another image of God? Explain
right.
Where that comes down.
And that's where the conversation is, I think, is still fuzzy, at least in my denomination. I mean, I experienced this as an attribute, because, I mean, I'm still a Christo-centric Christian person. So I experienced this as accessing an attribute of God, wisdom of the Holy One. What was so new to me was naming, just the name, the power of the name with a feminine, female gender.
No different than God's mercy.
Mercy,
God's wisdom, right.
God's rockness, right. God's, right.
Okay.
Right.
Which was part of the shock to, if you attended, to read in the newspaper that you'd been goddess worshiping.
Right.
Right.
Because
right.
you went,
yeah, I'm not a goddess.
I missed
right.
this part.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
It just wasn't part of the atmosphere at all.
So my spin on that is that it was the reactive press that created the goddess. It wasn't the conference.
Right. Right.
So, do you see what I mean?
And the press has made different statements depending upon the location in our country. I know in California, where I'm from, and I'm a Presbyterian.
Hey.
we got all this imagery of that we were now to call God the Father, Sophia, and that was not the intent of what was in Trump. It was the extreme radicals that were taking over and describing. They didn't understand that it was part of ritual, and I don't know if anyone who attended could ever agree with any of the statements that the press made. But those not in attendance came totally unglued, forgetting that our God is a loving God, a God that gives us our spirituality, and our God that gives us our sexuality. But they just reacted. And I know I happen to be in a very small Presbyterian church, but at the time, I was director of Christian education for one of the largest Presbyterian churches in our county. And I thought, oh boy, this is going to blow up in our face. The session, the congregation said, we have no issue with this. But other churches, particularly those with, oh, and this church I was in had lots of money. But a lot of you say follow the money. A lot of the Presbyterian churches that had money said they would not contribute to Presbytery or conferences if this was the type of thing that was going to happen. How do you study? How do you learn?
It seems like education is an important factor of anything, even in worship. If we don't educate our congregation,
right.
they don't know how to follow, and they know, well, what's she doing up there? That's weird today. I mean, they don't understand the depth of where this comes from. So when it's explained, it has more depth and more meaning. And also, I want to react to the sexuality. I don't think Lutherans have anything over the Presbyterians. We don't deal with the lower half of our body. I mean, we have a lower arm.
Yeah. All right.
Get pleasure in the right setting, and I just feel like, you know, hey, God, that's good. That's awesome. Thank you.
There's around my circle at the table, I was sitting by an esteemed older woman in the Presbyterian Church. She's been, I mean, we don't have an equivalent of the bishop, but she's been responsible for vast areas of the Midwest in the ministries there, and during the thigh nectar liturgy. I mean, during the liturgy that evoked profound images of female sexuality, she started to cry. And I noticed the tears. And later she wrote something. And this is what she said. A surprising affirmation came on Sunday morning in the liturgy. Women's bodily functions, specifically monthly menstrual periods, have been called the curse for generations. We were told that we will bear children in pain. We are called the temptress, the whore, not because of who we are individually, but because of the way we have been created. And yet the Bible says we have been created in the image of God and that it was good. But it didn't seem good. It was never publicly called good, except to be able to be wives and mothers. Until that liturgy, I can hardly describe the anger in me that melted away during that worship service. Powerful, powerful
experience. Some of the most moving stories were from women who attended the conference who were 70s, 80s, women who had been faithfully part of their congregations their entire lives, but always with a feeling that their hungers were not addressed, that there was not a place for them. And women who came to this conference, women that surprised me, that would come all this way to attend, and for the first time in their entire life of faithfulness, felt that they were a part of the body of Christ. And that was some of the most moving stories came from those women. And yet, for all their lives, they had remained faithful, and it was wonderful to see their reaction and their participation.
That's not the end of the controversy. If the controversy brewed over sexuality and over the accusation being goddess worship, the issue of Sophia, wisdom, the third piece of controversy brewed over the presentation of a Presbyterian, Dolores Williams. And she presented not in a plenary session to the whole group, but in a, an afternoon session of about 300 people on the topic of the atonement. And you may have seen some press on this. She's an African-American woman, and she talked about the African-American female experience of being surrogates during slave days, raising other people's children, and then being sexual surrogates, and still having a kind of surrogacy role in a lot of the employment that is able to be had. And so what she did then was she looked at one, this is my spin, there are many ways for us to perceive what happens in the atonement. There's no one doctrine of the atonement, but she took one expression of the atonement as the Jesus surrogate role, that is, he stands in for us. He does what no one else can do in our place. That's one strand of understanding of what happens on the cross. And she discounted that version of the atonement. And she did it in a sort of flippant way. For me, this is my spin. I wanted more theology from her. I wanted some other things from her, but she didn't offer those things. She said some things that were later picked up in the press and became for us, again, in the Presbyterian denomination, maybe the issue. And it's still raging. It'll be interesting to know where she speaks and when she speaks after that conference, you know.
What does she do? I mean, where do you...
She teaches at Union Theological Seminary, New York City. So sexuality, Sophia, and the atonement. That was a presentation to a much smaller group of people. Not everyone at the conference heard that presentation. We could go on and on about the controversy, but we want to close by talking about what's the way that the implications of this conference continue. And do you want to say something?
Yes. This Roman Catholic woman that was invited to come in and help with the rituals lost her job at the School of Divinity. Actually, she's working at the United Seminary now. And it's probably the best thing that could have happened to her, because she worked for seminarians in the Roman tradition before that were like putting up with her, like, oh, here's this woman. And she has so many people lined up for her classes at the United Seminary.